Enough. Rodanov passed the satchel over.
And if I have to use this thing?
Again, like we discussed, three times what I just paid you, waiting for you once it's done.
I want more than that, said the man. I want a place aboard the Sovereign.
Of course. Rodanov extended his hand, and the other man met his grip. They shook in the traditional Vajran fashion, clasping each other's forearms. You know I can always use a good man.
You're using him right now, eh? Just want to be sure I got a place to call home when all this is over. One way or another.
Utgar's grin was the faintest crescent of white against the shadows. 7. North by east on the Sea of Brass, with the wet southern wind on the starboard quarter, the poison orchid dashed across the waves like a racing mare at last given her head. It was the third day of Orim. After a day lost laboriously navigating the twisting, rock-choked passage called the Trader's Gate, they had spent two more dodging reefs and islands, until the last jungle-crowned dome and the last volcanic smoke of the ghost winds had been sunk beneath the horizon. "This is the game," said Drakasha, addressing the group she'd assembled on the quarterdeck. Delmastro, Tregan, Gwilym, Utgar, Nazreen, Oskal, and all the skilled mates, carpenters, sailmakers, and so forth. Mumchance listened from his place at the wheel, and Locke listened from the quarterdeck stairs, along with Jean and a half-dozen off-watch sailors. If they hadn't exactly been invited to hear the captain's little speech, neither had they been dissuaded. There was no point when news would travel across a ship faster than fire. "We're bound for Tal Vahrah," said Drakasha. "We're going to allow our new friends Ravel and Valora to conduct a bit of sneaky business ashore."
"Bounty," said Mumchance.
"He's right," said Gwilym. "Begging your pardon, Captain, but if we haul up in sight of Tal Vahrah..."
"If the poison orchid drops anchor, aye, I'm worth a lot of money. But if we make some adjustments to my pretty ship here and there, alter the sail plan a bit, swap my stern lanterns for something plainer, and paint a false name in huge damn letters at the stern..."
"What shall we call her, Captain?" asked the carpenter.
"I'm partial to Chimera."
"That's cheeky," said Tregan. "But what's the gain for the rest of us in this sneaky business, Drakasha?"
"Nothing I care to discuss before the deed is done," said Drakasha. "But the gain for all of us will be substantial. You might say we're going out with the blessing of the whole Council of Captains."
"Then why aren't they out here lending a hand?" asked Nazreen.
"Because there's only one captain who's best at what she does." Drakasha gave an exaggerated curtsy. "Now, back to duties or to slacking, as you were. Spread the word to everyone." Locke was slacking a few minutes later, alone with his thoughts at the larboard rail, when Jean took the spot beside him. The sea and sky alike were bronzing around the setting sun, and the warm ocean air was nonetheless refreshing after the sweaty atmosphere of the ghost winds.
"You feel anything strange?" asked Jean.
"What, about the... oh, you mean the poison? No, can't say that I feel any better or worse than I have for a while. But, I'm sure I'll try to get a message to you if I start vomiting up newts or something. Assuming you could hear anyone knocking at that cabin door..."
"Oh, not you two. Esri nearly tipped Gwilym over the taffrail."
"Well, let's be honest, people will notice the sort of racket that generally accompanies an attack upon the ship."
"And now you're about to have a sudden accident."
"By Jeremite Redeemers mounted on cavalry steeds. Where do you find the energy?"
"She makes it easy," said Jean.
"Ah."
"She asked me to stay," said Jean, looking down at his hands.
"Aboard the ship, once all of this is over, assuming there's anything left of us?"
Jean nodded.
And by me, I'm sure she meant you as well. Oh, of course she did, said Locke, not entirely curbing his reflexive tone of sarcasm. What did you say?
I asked her.
I thought maybe she could come with us. You love her, Locke nodded to himself before Jean could answer. You're not just marking time while we're out here. You've really fallen off the cliff, haven't you?
Yeah,
Jean whispered. She's good, said Locke. She's got wits and fire. She has a real taste for taking things away from people at sword point, which is an asset in my book. And at least her you can trust at your back in a fight.
I've always trusted you.
To be at your back in a fight, sure. But her you can trust not to embarrass everyone before it's over. You two won the day on the Kingfisher, not me. And I saw how she got kicked around. Most people would have hugged their hammocks for a few days after that. She's too damn stubborn to stop moving. You two really are a good match.
You make it sound like it's her or you.
Of course it doesn't have to be, but things will change.
Change, yes, and improve. This doesn't have to mean the end of anything.
Take her with us? Three against the world? Start up the whole thing again? Rebuild a gang? Haven't we had this conversation before?
Yes, and
I was doing my best impression of a drunken asshole at the time, I know. Locke put his left hand atop Jean's right. You're right. Things can change and improve. We've seen it happen to other people. Maybe it can happen to us for once. Soon as we finish the Sinspire game, we'll be richer than hell and no longer welcome in Tal Vahrar's polite society. She could come with us, or you could stay with her.
I don't know yet, said Jean. Neither of us knows. We've decided to deal with the question by ignoring it for the duration of the voyage.
Excellent idea.
But I want...
Listen, when the time comes, you make whatever choice you need to, and you don't think about me, understand? It is a fine match. Maybe you could do better.
Locke grinned to let Jean know that there was no actual need to knock his brains out of his skull.
But I know for a solid fact that she couldn't. Ever. So saying, he squeezed Jean's hand. I'm happy for you. You've gone and stolen something back from this whole dead-end distraction Stragos has shoved us into. Hold it tight.
There seemed nothing else to say, so they stood listening to the cries of the circling gulls and watched the sun sink into the far horizon, bleeding its fire into the sea. Eventually, heavy footsteps sounded on the quarterdeck stairs behind them.
My boys, said Drakasha, appearing behind them and draping her arms across their shoulders. Just the pair I wanted to speak with. I am removing you from afternoon watch duty with all the other Reds.
That's generous, said Locke.
No, it isn't. From now on, you're detached to the Carpenter's Mercy for afternoons. Since we're slipping into Tal Vahrar for your benefit, most of the alterations to the Orchid are going to be your responsibility. Painting, carving, rigging. You two will be rather busy.
Wow, said Locke. That sounds like an absolutely grand way to spend the voyage.
It wasn't.
8.
Land ho! Cried the early evening foremast watch. Land and fire! 1 point on the starboard bow!
Fire? Locke looked up from his hand in the card game that had broken out in the undercastle.
Shit!
He dropped his cards to the deck, forfeiting his 7 solari bet for the round. Nearly a year's pay for an honest Vahrari labourer. Common stakes for the games that took place after shares were paid out. There was a lot of spare coinage floating around the ship since they'd left Port Prodigal in such a hurry. Emerging from the undercastle, he nearly slammed into Del Mastro.
Lieutenant, is that Tal Vahrar?
Has to be.
And the fire? Is that certain?
Fire in the city could mean some sort of disaster, or it could mean civil war.
chaos. Stragos might already be dead, or besieged, or even victorious, and therefore in no further need of Locke or Jean.
It's the 21st, Ravel.
I know what bloody day it is, I just... Oh.
Oh!
The 21st of Orim, the Festa Iono, the grand pageant of the Lord of the Grasping Waters. Locke sighed with relief. Away from the usual rhythms of the city, he'd all but forgotten about the holiday. At the Festa Iono, the Verari gave thanks for Iono's influence on the city's fortunes by ceremonially burning old ships, while thousands of drunkards made a mess of the streets and canals. Locke had only ever seen it from the balconies of the Sinspire, but it was a lively time. Hell, that would make slipping into the city easier. There'd be a thousand things going on to keep the watch busy.
"All hands!" came the cry from astern. "All hands at the waist! Captain wants a word!"
Locke grinned. In the event of an all-hands call during a card game, the game had to stop, and everyone with a stake in the pot got it back. His 7 solari would be returning home soon enough. The orchids mustered noisily at the waist, and after a few minutes were waved to silence by Drakasha. The captain set an empty cask beside the mainmast, and Lieutenant Del Mastro leapt atop it, wearing a respectable overcoat from the ship's store of fine clothing.
"For the rest of the night," she shouted, "wear the Chimera, and we've never even heard of the poison orchid. I'm the captain. I'll be pacing the quarterdeck if anyone needs anything, and Drakasha will be in her cabin unless things go to hell. If another ship hails us, I'll be the one that answers. The rest of you pretend that you don't speak Therin. Our task is to deliver 2 of our new friends to shore, for a job that'll be important to us all. Ravel, Valora, we'll send you out in the same boat you donated to our cause all those weeks ago."
She paused to allow a sudden outburst of chatter to die off.
"We should drop anchor in the next 2 hours. If you're not back by sunrise, this ship will be gone, and we'll never come within 500 miles of this city again."
"We understand," said Locke.
"Once the anchor's down," continued Del Mastro, "I'll want double watches aloft. Rig razor nets on both sides for a quick raise, but leave them down. Lay pole arms at the sides, up against the rails, and ready sabers at both the masts. If a customs boat or anything else carrying a uniform tries to pay us a visit, we'll invite them aboard and detain them for the night. If anything more than that troubles us, we repel boarders, lay on the canvas, and run like hell."
There was a general murmur of approval to that idea.
"That's it. Stand in to Tal Verar. Mum Chance, put us about a mile off the Emerald Galleries, and raise an Ashmiri grey ensign at the taffrail."
Ashmir, though lacking a merchant or military fleet of its own, did a brisk business in registrations of convenience for smugglers, bounty privateers, and tariff-dodging merchants. Nobody would look twice at them for the sake of that ensign. More importantly, nobody would approach merely for the sake of making small talk with fellow countrymen far from home. Locke approved. And anchoring in the waters southeast of the city would give them a good approach to the Castellana, so they could drop in on Stragos without lurking too close to the crowded marinas or the main anchorage.
"Hey!" said Utgar, slapping Locke and Jean on the backs. "You two, what the hell are you getting yourselves into? You want a bodyguard?"
"Ravel's the only bodyguard I need," said Jean with a smirk.
"Fair enough, I'll give you that. But what are you sticking your noses into, Something dangerous?"
"Probably not," said Locke. "Look, Drakasha will spin the full tale, probably sooner than you think. For tonight, let's just say we're on ordinary errands."
"Saying hello to grandmother," said Jean. "Paying off uncle's gambling debts. Picking up 3 loaves of bread and a bushel of onions at the night market."
"Fine, fine. Keep your secrets. Rest of us'll stay behind and be bored, right?"
"Not likely," said Locke. "This ship's full of little surprises, isn't it?"
"True enough," said Utgard, chuckling. "True enough, hey? Well, be careful. Eyes of the gods upon you and all that."
"Thanks." Locke scratched his beard and then snapped his fingers. "Hell, I nearly forgot something. Jerome, Utgard, see you in a bit." He jogged aft, dodging blue watchwork parties and bored reds helping haul forth weapons from the arms lockers. He took the quarterdeck stairs in two quick leaps, slid down the companionway rails, and knocked loudly on Trakasha's cabin door.
"It's open," she shouted.
"Captain," said Locke, closing the door behind him, "I need to borrow the money that was in my sea chest again." Trakasha was lounging on her hammock with Paolo and Cosetta, reading to them from a heavy book that looked an awful lot like a wise mariner's practical lexicon.
"Technically, that money got cut up into shares," she said. "But I can give you the equivalent out of the ship's purse. All of it?"
250 solari should do."
"Oh, it, won't be coming back with me."
"Fascinating," she said. "That's a definition of borrow that doesn't exactly compel me to get up from this hammock. On your way out..."
"Captain, Stragos is just one half of tonight's business. I need to keep Requin purring, too. He has the power to crush this scheme like an insect if I don't. Besides, if I tickle his fancy, there's one more useful item I might be able to squeeze out of him, now that I think of it."
"So you need a bribe?"
"Between friends, we call them considerations."
"Come on, Trakasha. Consider it an investment in our desired outcome."
"For the sake of my peace and quiet, fine. I'll have it waiting for you when you leave the ship."
"You're too..."
"I am not even remotely too kind. Begone."
9. They'd been away for 7 weeks that felt like a lifetime. Standing at the larboard rail, staring once again at the islands and towers of Tal Varar, Locke felt anxiety and melancholy mingling like liquors. The clouds were low and dark above the city, reflecting the orange light of the festival fire burning in the main anchorage.
"Ready for this?" asked Jean.
"Ready and sweating heavily," said Locke. They were dressed in borrowed finery, linen caps and cloaks. The cloaks were too warm, but not so rare on the streets of many neighborhoods. They meant that the wearer was probably carrying weapons, and not to be trifled with. Hopefully the added clothing would help protect them from a casual glimpse by anyone inconvenient who might recognize them.
"Heave out!"
cried Oscar, in charge of the party putting their boat over the side. With the creak of rope and tackle, the little craft swung out into darkness and splashed down into the water. Utgard shimmied down the boarding net to unfasten everything and prepare the oars. As Locke stepped to the entry port and prepared to go down, Del Mastro caught his arm.
"Whatever else happens," she whispered, "just bring him back."
"I won't fail," said Locke, "and neither will he."
"Zamira said to give you this."
Del Mastro passed over a heavy leather purse packed tight with coins. Locke nodded his gratitude and slipped it into an inner cloak pocket. As Locke crawled down to the boat, he passed Utgard, who gave a cheery salute and kept climbing. Locke hopped down into the boat, but continued clinging to the boarding net so he could stand upright. He glanced up, and by the light of the ship's lanterns he saw Jean and Ezri saying farewell with a kiss. She whispered something to him, and then they parted.
"This is infinitely preferable to the last time we shared this boat alone," said Jean as they settled onto the rowing bench and fit the oars to their locks.
"You told her your real name, didn't you?"
"What?"
Jean's eyes grew wide, and then he scowled.
"Is that a guess?"
"I'm not much of a lip-reader, but the last thing she said to you had one syllable, not two."
"Oh," sighed Jean. "Well, aren't you the clever little bastard?"
"Yes, on all three counts, actually."
"I did, and I'm not sorry."
"Gods, I'm not angry, Jean. I'm just showing off. They began to row together, pulling hard, driving the boat across the dark, choppy water toward the channel between the Galezzo district and the Emerald Galleries. Minutes of rowing passed without conversation. The oars creaked, the water splashed, and the poison orchid fell away to stern, the whiteness of her furled sails vanishing into the darkness, until all that remained of her was a faint constellation of lantern lights. "The alchemist," said Locke, without any warning.
"Huh?"
"Stragos alchemist. He's the key to this mess."
"If by key you mean cause."
"No, listen. How likely is it that Stragos is ever going to just accidentally leave us the glasses he uses to give us our antidote? Or let a dose slip out of his pocket?"
"Easy question," said Jean. "It's bloody impossible."
"Right. So it's no use waiting for him to make a mistake. We've got to make contact with that alchemist."
"He's one of the Archon's personal retinue," said Jean. "Maybe the most important person in Stragos' service, if Stragos makes a habit of doing this frequently. I doubt he has a nice, convenient, out-of-the-way house where we can pay him a visit. He probably lives at the Mon Magisteria."
"But there's got to be something we can do," said Locke. "The man has to have a price. Think of what we've got at the Sinspire, or what we could get with Dracasha's help."
"I'll admit it's the best idea yet," said Jean. "Which isn't saying much."
"Eyes wide, ears open, and hope in the crooked warden," Locke muttered. On this side of the city, Tal Vahrar's inner harbour was thick with pleasure boats, barges, and hired gondolas. The wealthy, and the not-so-wealthy who didn't care whether or not they woke up without a sentira the next day, were in full migration from the professional crescents to the bars and coffee-houses of the Emerald Galleries. Locke and Jean slipped into the stream and rowed against the prevailing current, dodging larger vessels and exchanging choice vulgarities with the shouting, leering, bottle-throwing customers on some of the rowdier barges. Having dished out more abuse than they'd received, they slipped at last between the Artificer's Crescent and the Alchemist's Crescent, admiring the vivid blue and green fireballs that the alchemists were hurling, presumably in support of the Festa, though one never knew, 40 or 50 feet into the air over their private docks. The prevailing wind was toward Locke and Jean, and as they rowed they found themselves pursued by a brimstone-scented rain of sparks and burnt paper scraps. Their destination was easy enough to find. At the northwestern end of the Castellana lay the entrance grotto to the Elderglass caverns from which they'd emerged with Meraine, the first night she'd kidnapped them on the Archon's behalf. Security at the Archon's private landing had been enhanced. As Locke and Jean rowed around the final bend into the prismatic glass hollow, a dozen eyes hefted crossbows and knelt behind curved iron shields 5 feet high, set into the floor to provide cover. Behind them a squad of regular Vahrari soldiers manned a ballista, a minor siege engine capable of shattering their boat with a 10-pound quarrel. An eye officer pulled a chain leading into a wall aperture, presumably ringing an alarm above.
"Use of this landing is forbidden," shouted the officer.
"Please listen carefully," shouted Locke. The dull roar of the waterfall high above echoed throughout the cavern, and there was no room for error. "We have a message for the waiting lady."
Their boat bumped up against the edge of the landing. It was disconcerting, thought Locke, having so many crossbows, large and small, dedicated to their intimidation. However, the eye officer stepped over and knelt beside them. His voice echoed metallically through the speaking holes of his featureless mask.
"You're here on the waiting lady's business?"
"We are," said Locke. "Tell her precisely this. 2 sparks were kindled, and 2 bright fires returned."
"I shall," said the officer.
"In the meantime..."
After carefully setting their crossbows down, half a dozen eyes stepped out from behind their shields to haul Locke and Jean out of their boat. They were restrained and patted down. Their boot daggers were confiscated, along with Locke's bag of gold. An eye examined it, and then passed it to the officer.
"Solari, sir. Confiscate it?"
"No," said the officer.
Take them to the waiting lady's chamber and give it back. If money alone could kill the protector, the priori would have already done it, eh? 10.
You did what to the red messenger?
Maxilan Stragos was red-faced with wine, exertion, and surprise. The Archon was dressed more sumptuously than Locke had ever seen him, in a vertically striped cape of sea-green silk that alternated with cloth of gold strips over a coat and breeches that also gleamed gold. He wore rings on all 10 of his fingers, set alternately with rubies and sapphires, very close approximations of the Tal Varrar colours. He stood before Locke and Jean in a tapestry-walled chamber on the first floor of the Mon Magisteria, attended by a pair of eyes. If Locke and Jean had not been granted chairs, neither had they been trussed up, or placed in the sweltering chamber.
We, used it to initiate successful contact with pirates. By losing it to them?
In a word, yes.
And Caldris is dead?
For some time.
Now tell me, Lamora, just what sort of reaction were you hoping for when you brought me this news?
Well, a fucking heart attack would have been nice, but I'd settle for a bit of patience while I explain further.
Yes, said the Archon. Do.
When the messenger was taken by pirates, all of us aboard were made prisoners. Locke had decided that the specific details of injuries and scrub watches and so forth could be safely left out of the story.
By whom?
Drakasha.
Zamira lives, does she? With her old poison orchid?
Yes, said Locke. It's in fine condition, and in fact it's currently riding at anchor about 2 miles, he pointed with a finger at what he believed to be south, that way.
She dares?
She's practicing an obscure technique called disguise, Stragos.
So you're part of her crew now?
Yes. Those of us taken from the messenger were given a chance to prove our intentions by storming the next prize Drakasha took. You won't see the messenger again, as it's been sold to a sort of, wrecker baron. But at least now we're in a position to give you what you want.
Are you?
The expression on Stragos' face went from annoyance to plain avarice in an eye blink.
How refreshing to hear you deliver such a report in lieu of vulgarity and complaint.
Vulgarity and complaint are my special talents, but listen. Drakasha has agreed to drum up the scare you want. If we get our antidote tonight, by the end of the week, you'll have reports of raids at every point of the compass. It'll be like dropping a shark in a public bath.
What do you mean precisely by Drakasha has agreed?
Improvising a fictional motive for Zamira was elementary. Locke could have done it in his sleep. I told her the truth, he said. The rest was easy. Obviously, once our job is done, you'll send your navy south to kick 16 shades of shit out of every Ghostwind pirate you find. Except the one that actually started the mess, who will conveniently hunt elsewhere for a few months. And once you've got your grand little war sewn up, she goes back home to find that her former rivals are on the bottom of the ocean. Alas.
I see, said Stragos. I would have preferred not to have her aware of my actual intentions.
If there are any survivors in the Ghostwinds, said Locke, she can hardly speak of her role in the matter to them, can she? And if there are no survivors, who can she talk to at all?
Indeed, muttered Stragos.
However, said Jean, if the two of us don't return quite soon, the Orchid will head for the open sea, and you'll lose your one chance to make use of her.
And I will have wasted the messenger, and poisoned my reputation, and endured the abuse of your company, all for nothing. Yes, Tannen, I'm well aware of the angles of what you no doubt believe to be a terribly clever argument.
Our antidote, then?
You've not earned a final cure yet, but you'll have the consequences further postponed."
Stragos pointed to one of the eyes, who bowed and left the room. He returned a few moments later and held the door open for two people. The first was Stragos' personal alchemist, carrying a domed silver serving tray. The second was Meraine.
"Our two bright fires have returned," she said.
She was dressed in a long-sleeved gown that matched the sea-green portions of Stragos' cape, and her slender waist was accented by a tight cloth of gold sash. Threaded into her hair was a circlet of red and blue rose blossoms.
"Costa and the Ferrer have earned another temporary slip of life, my dear."
He held out his arm, and she crossed over to him, taking his elbow in the light and friendly fashion of a chaperone rather than a lover.
"Have they now?"
"I'll tell you about it when we return to the gardens."
"Some sort of Festa Yono affair, Stragos? You've never struck me as the celebratory type," said Locke.
"For the sake of my officers," said Stragos, "if I throw galas for them, the priori spread rumors that I am profligate. If I do nothing, they whisper that I am austere and heartless. Regardless, my officers suffer far more in society when they have no private functions from which to exclude their jealous rivals. Thus I put my gardens to use, if nothing else."
"I weep again for your hardship," said Locke, "forced by cruel circumstance to throw garden parties." Stragos smiled thinly and gestured at his alchemist. The man swept the dome from the silver tray, revealing two white-frosted crystal goblets full of familiar pale amber liquid.
"You may have your antidote in pear cider tonight," said the Archon, "for old time's sake."
"Oh, you funny old bastard." Locke passed a goblet to Jean, emptied his in several gulps, and then tossed it into the air.
"Heavens, I slipped!"
The crystal goblet struck the stone floor with a loud clang rather than a shattering explosion into fragments. It bounced once and rolled into a corner, completely unharmed.
"A little gift from the master alchemists." Stragos looked extraordinarily amused. "Hardly elderglass, but just the thing to deny rude guests their petty satisfactions."
Jean finished his own cider and set his glass back down on the bald man's serving tray. One of the eyes fetched the other goblet, and when they were both covered by the silver dome once again, Stragos dismissed his alchemist with a wave.
Said Locke, but the man was already out the door. "This evening's business is concluded," said Stragos. "Meraine and I have a gala to return to. Costa and De Ferra, you have the most important part of your task ahead of you. Please me, and I may just yet make it worth your while."
Stragos led Meraine to the door, turning only to speak to one of his eyes.
"Lock them in here for 10 minutes. After that, escort them back to their boat. Return their weapons and see that they're on their way. With haste."
Damn! Locke sputtered as the door slammed closed behind the two eyes.
"Antidote," said Jean. "That's all that matters for now. Antidote."
"I suppose..." Locke put his head against one of the room's stone walls. "Gods, I hope our visit to Requin goes more smoothly than this." 11.
"Service entrance, you ignorant bastard!"
The Sinspire bouncer came out of nowhere. He doubled Locke over his knee, knocking the wind out of him in one cruel slam, and hurled him back onto the gravel of the lantern-lit courtyard behind the tower. Locke hadn't even stepped inside, merely approached the door after failing to spot anyone he could easily bribe for an audience with Selendri.
"Oof!"
he said as the ground made his acquaintance. Jean, guided more by loyal reflex than clear thinking, got involved as the bouncer came forth to offer Locke further punishment. The bouncer growled and swung a too casual fist at Jean, who caught it in his right hand and then broke several of the bouncer's ribs with the heel of his left. Before Locke could say anything, Jean kicked the bouncer in the groin and swept his legs out from beneath him.
Urgak!
The man said as the ground made his acquaintance. The next attendant at the door had a knife. Jean broke the fist that held it and bounced the attendant off the Sinspire wall like a handball from a stone court surface. The next six or seven attendants who surrounded them, unfortunately, had short swords and crossbows.
"You have no idea who you're fucking with," said one of them.
"Actually,"
came a harsh feminine whisper from the service entrance,
"I suspect they do."
Selendri wore a blue and red silk evening gown that must have cost as much as a gilded carriage. Her ruined arm was covered by a sleeve that led down to her brass hand, while the fine muscles and smooth skin of her other arm were bare, accentuated by gold and elderglass bangles.
"We caught them trying to steal into the service entrance, mistress," said one of the attendants.
"You caught us getting near the service entrance, you dumb bastard!" Locke rose to his knees. "Selendri, we need to..."
"I'm sure you do," she said. "Let them go. I'll deal with them myself. Act as though nothing happened."
"But he... God, I think he broke my ribs,"
wheezed the first man Jean had dealt with. The other was unconscious.
"If you agree that nothing happened," said Selendri, "I'll have you taken to a physica. Did anything happen?"
No. No, mistress. Nothing happened."
"Good."
As she turned to re-enter the service area, Locke stumbled to his feet, clutching his stomach, and reached out to grab her gently by the shoulder. She whirled on him.
"Selendri," he whispered, "we cannot be seen on the gaming floors. We have..." "Powerful individuals rather upset about your failure to give them a return engagement?"
She knocked his hand away. "Forgive me, and yes, that's exactly it."
"Durenna and Corvalur are on the fifth floor. You and I can take the climbing closet from the third."
"And Jerome?"
"Stay here in the service area, Valora."
She pulled them both in through the service entrance so tray-bearing attendants, studiously ignoring the injured men on the ground, could get on with earning festival night tips from the city's least inhibited.
"Thank you,"
said Jean, taking a half-hidden spot behind tall wooden racks full of unwashed dishes.
"I'll give instructions to ignore you," said Selendri, "as long as you ignore my people."
"I'll be a saint," said Jean.
Selendri grabbed a passing attendant with no serving tray and whispered a few terse instructions into his ear. Locke caught the words "dog-leech" and "dock their pay." Then he was following Selendri into the crowd on the ground floor, hunched over as though trying to shrink down beneath his cloak and cap, praying that the next and only person who'd recognize him would be Requin. 12.
7 weeks, said the master of the Sinspire. "Selendri was so sure we'd never see you again."
3 weeks down and 3 weeks back, said Locke. "Barely spent a week in Port Prodigal itself."
"You certainly look as though you passed some time on deck, working for your berth."
"Ordinary sailors attract much less notice than paying passengers."
"I suppose they do. Is that your natural hair color?"
"I think so. Swap it as often as I have and you start to lose track." The wide balcony doors on the eastern side of Requin's office were open, but for a fine mesh screen to keep out insects. Through it, Locke could see the torch-like pyres of two ships in the harbour, surrounded by hundreds of specks of lantern light that had to be spectators in smaller craft.
"They're burning 4 this year," said Requin, noticing that the view had caught Locke's attention. "One for each season. I think they're just finishing the third. The fourth should go up soon, and then all will be well. Fewer people in the streets, and more crowding into the chance houses."
Locke nodded and turned to admire what Requin had done with the suite of chairs he'd had crafted for him. He tried to keep a smirk of glee off his face and managed to look only vaguely appreciative. The four replica chairs were placed around a thin-legged table in a matching style, holding bottles of wine and an artful flower arrangement.
"Is that a replica as well? I'm afraid so. Your gift spurred me to have it made."
"My gift? Speaking of which..." Locke reached beneath his cloak, removed the purse, and set it down atop Requin's desk.
"What's this?"
"A consideration," said Locke. "There are an awful lot of sailors in Port Prodigal with more coins than card sense." Requin opened the satchel and raised an eyebrow.
"Handsome," he said. "You really are trying very hard not to piss me off, aren't you?"
"I want my job," said Locke, "now more than ever."
"Let's discuss your task, then. Does this Carlo Callas still exist?"
"Yes," said Locke. "He's down there."
"Then why the hell didn't you bring him back with you?"
"He's out of his fucking mind," said Locke.
"Then he's useless."
"No, not useless. He feels persecuted, Requin. He's delusional. He imagines that the Priori and the Artificers have agents on every corner in Port Prodigal, every ship, every tavern. He barely leaves his house." Locke took pleasure at the speed with which he was conjuring an imaginary life for an imaginary man. "But what he does inside that house, what he has, locks, hundreds of them, clockwork devices, a private forge and bellows, he's as insatiable about his trade as he ever was. It's all he has left in the world."
"How is a madman's detritus significant?"
asked Selendri. She stood between two of Requin's exquisite oil paintings, leaning against the wall with her arms folded. "I experimented with all kinds of things back when I thought I might have a chance to crack this tower's vault. Acids, oils, abrasives, different types of picks and tools. I call myself a fair judge of mechanisms as well as lock-breaking. And the things this bastard can do, the things he builds and invents, even with a magpie mind..." Locke spread his hands and shrugged theatrically. "Gods!"
"What will it take to bring him here?"
"He wants protection," said Locke. "He's not averse to leaving Port Prodigal. Hell, he's eager to. But he imagines death at every step. He needs to feel that someone with power is reaching out to pull him under their cloak."
"Oh, you could just hit him over the head and haul him back in chains," said Selendri.
"And risk losing his actual cooperation forever? Worse, deal with him on a 3-week voyage after he wakes up? His mind is delicate as glass, Selendri. I wouldn't recommend knocking it around." Locke cracked his knuckles. Time to sweeten the pitch. "Look, you want this man back in Tal Vahrar. He'll drive you mad. You may even have to appoint some sort of nurse or minder for him, and you'll definitely have to hide him from the Artificers. But the things he can do could make it worthwhile 100 times over. He's the best lockbreaker I've ever seen. He just needs to believe that I truly represent you."
"What do you suggest?"
"You have a wax sigil on your ledgers and letters of credit. I've seen it, making my deposits. Put your seal on a sheet of parchment."
"And incriminate myself?" said Requin. "No."
"Already thought about that," said Locke. "Don't write a name on it. Don't date it. Don't sign it to anyone. Don't even add your usual R. Just write something pleasant and totally non-specific. Look forward to comfort and hospitality, or expect every due consideration."
"Trite bullshit. I see," said Requin.
He removed a sheet of parchment from a desk drawer, touched a quill to ink, and scrawled a few sentences. After sprinkling the letter with alchemical desiccant, he looked back at Locke.
"And this childish device will be sufficient?"
"As far as his fears are concerned," said Locke, "Callas is a child. He'll grab at this like a baby grabbing for a tit.
Or a grown man,
muttered Selendri. Requin smiled. Gloved as always, he removed the glass cylinder from a small lamp atop his desk, revealing a candle at its heart. With this, he heated a stick of black wax, which he allowed to drip into a pool on the sheet of parchment. At last, he withdrew a heavy signet ring from a jacket pocket and pressed it into the wax.
Your bait, Master Costa.
He passed the sheet over.
The fact that you're skulking at the service entrance and trying to hide beneath that cloak both suggest you're not planning on staying in the city for long.
Back south in a day or two, as soon as my shipmates finish offloading the, completely legitimate and responsibly acquired cargo we picked up in Port Prodigal. That was a safe lie. With dozens of ships offloading in the city every day, at least a few of them had to be carrying goods from criminal sources.
And you'll bring Callus back with you?
Yes.
If the sigil isn't sufficient, promise him anything else reasonable. Coin, drugs, drink, women, men, both. And if that's not enough, take Selendri's suggestion and let me worry about his state of mind. Don't come back empty-handed.
As you wish.
What then for you and the Archon? With Callus in hand, you'll likely be back to this scheme for my vault.
I don't know, said Locke. I'll be at least 6 or 7 weeks away before I can come back with him. Why don't you ponder how I can best serve you in that time? Whatever plan you deem suitable. If you want me to turn him over to the Archon as a double agent, fine. If you want me to tell the Archon that he died or something, I just don't know. My skull aches. You're the man with the big picture. I'll look forward to new orders.
If you can stay this polite, said Requin, hefting the purse, bring me Callus and continue to be so satisfied with your place in the scheme of things, you may well have a future in my service.
I appreciate that.
Go. Selendri will show you out. I still have a busy night lying in wait for me.
Locke let a bit of his actual relief show in his expression. This web of lies was growing so convoluted, so branching, and so delicate, that a moth's fart might knock it to pieces. But the two meetings of the night had bought what he and Jean needed. Another 2 months of life from Stragos, and another 2 months of tolerance from Requin. All they needed to do now was steal back to their boat without complication and row themselves to safety. 13.
We're being followed, said Jean as they crossed the Sinspire service courtyard. They were headed back toward the maze of alleys and hedgerows from which they'd come, the little used block of gardens and service paths behind the lesser chance houses. Their boat was tied up at a pier along the inner docks of the great gallery. They'd snuck up to the top of the golden steps on rickety stairs, ignoring the lift boxes and streets on which a thousand complications might lurk.
Where are they?
Across the street, watching this courtyard. They moved when we moved just now.
Shit, muttered Locke. If only this city's entire population of lurking assholes shared one set of balls so I could kick it repeatedly.
At the edge of the courtyard, let's make a really obvious sudden dash for it, said Jean. Hide yourself. Whoever comes running after us gets to explain some things the hard way. At the rear of the courtyard was a hedge twice Locke's height. An archway surrounded by empty crates and casks led to the dark and little-used backside of the golden steps. About 10 yards from this archway, acting in unison by some unspoken signal, Locke and Jean broke into a sprint. Through the arch, into the shadowed alley beyond, Locke knew they had just moments to hide themselves. They needed to be far enough from the courtyard to prevent any of the Sinspire attendants from glimpsing a scuffle. Past the backs of gardens and walled lawns they ran, scant yards from buildings where hundreds of the richest people in the Therin world were losing money for fun. At last they found two stacks of empty casks on either side of the alley, the most obvious ambush spot possible, but if their opponents thought they were hell-bent on escape, they might just ignore the possibility. Jean had already vanished into his place. Locke pulled his boot dagger, feeling the hammer of his own heartbeat, and crouched behind the casks on his side of the alley. He threw his cloaked arm across his face, leaving only his eyes and forehead exposed. The rapid slap of leather on stones, and then two dark shapes flew past the piles of casks. Locke deliberately delayed his own movement half a heartbeat, allowing Jean to strike first. When the pursuer closest to Locke turned, startled by the sound of Jean's attack on his companion, Locke slipped forward, dagger out, filled with grim elation at the thought of finally getting some answers to this business. His grab for the attacker was good. He slipped his left arm around the man's neck at the exact instant he shoved his blade up against the soft junction of neck and chin on the other side. "Drop your weapon, or I'll..." was all he had time to say, however, before the man did the absolute worst thing possible. He jerked forward in an attempt to break Locke's hold, perhaps reflexively, not realizing the angle at which Locke's blade was poised. Whether it was supreme optimism or miserable foolishness, Locke would never know, as the man sliced half the contents of his neck open and died that instant, spewing blood. A weapon clattered to the stones from his limp fingers. Locke put his hands up in disbelief and let the corpse drop, only to find himself facing Jean, who was breathing heavily over the unmoving form of his own opponent. "Wait a minute," said Locke. "You mean..." "Accident," said Jean. "I caught his knife, we fought a bit, and he got it beneath his own ribcage." "God damn it," Locke muttered, flicking blood from his right hand. "You try to keep a bastard alive, and look what happens." "Crossbows," said Jean. He pointed to the ground, where Locke's adjusting eyes could see the dim shapes of two small hand crossbows. "Alley pieces, the sort of thing you used within 10 yards or not at all. Grab them. There may be more of them after us." "Hell!" Locke grabbed one of the bows and gingerly handed the other to Jean. The little quarrels might be poisoned. The thought of handling someone else's envenomed weapon in the dark made his skin crawl. But Jean was right. They'd need the advantage if they had other pursuers. "I say discretion is a pastime for other people," said Locke. "Let's run our asses off." They sprinted at a wild tear through the forgotten places of the Golden Steps, north to the edge of the vast Elderglass Plateau, where they scrambled down flight after flight of nauseatingly wobbly wooden steps, glancing frantically above and below for pursuit or ambush. The world was a dizzy whirl around Locke by the middle of the staircase, painted in the surreal colours of fire and alien glass. Out on the harbour, the fourth and final ship of the festival was bursting into incandescence, a sacrifice of wood and pitch and canvas before hundreds of small boats packed with priests and revellers. Down to the feet of the stairs and across the wooden platforms of the inner docks they stumbled, past the occasional drunkard or beggar, waving their daggers and crossbows wildly. Before them was their pier, long and empty, home only to a long stack of crates. No beggars, no drunks. Their boat bobbed welcomingly on the waves, just 100 feet away now, brightly lit by the glare of the inferno. "Stack of crates," Locke thought, and by then it was too late. Two men stepped from the shadows as Locke and Jean passed, from the most obvious ambush spot possible. Locke and Jean whirled together. Only the fact that they were carrying their stolen crossbows in their hands gave them any chance to bring them up in time. Four arms flew out. Four men standing close enough to hold hands drew on their targets. Four fingers quivered, each separated from their triggers by no more than the width of a single droplet of sweat. Locke Lamora stood on the pier in Tal Varar with the hot wind of a burning ship at his back and the cold bite of a loaded crossbow's bolt at his neck. 14. He grinned, gasping for breath, and concentrated on holding his own crossbow level with the left eye of his opponent. They were close enough that they would catch most of one another's blood, should they both twitch their fingers at the same time.
"Be reasonable," said the man facing him.
Beads of sweat left visible trails as they slid down his grime-covered cheeks and forehead.
"Consider the disadvantages of your situation."
Locke snorted. "Unless your eyeballs are made of iron, the disadvantage is mutual. Wouldn't you say so, Jean?" Jean and his foe were toe to toe with their crossbows similarly poised. Not one of them could miss at this range, not if all the gods above or below the heavens willed it otherwise.
"All four of us would seem to be up to our balls in quicksand," said Jean between breaths.
On the water behind them, the old galleon groaned and creaked as the roaring flames consumed it from the inside out. Night was made day for hundreds of yards around. The hull was crisscrossed with white-orange lines of seams coming apart. Smoke boiled out of those hellish cracks in little black eruptions, the last shuddering breaths of a vast wooden beast dying in agony. The four men stood on their pier, strangely alone in the midst of light and noise that was drawing the attention of the entire city. Nobody in the boats was paying any attention to them.
"Lower your piece, for the love of the gods," said Locke's opponent. "We've been instructed not to kill you if we don't have to."
"And I'm sure you'd be honest if it were otherwise, of course," said Locke. His smile grew. "I make it a point never to trust men with weapons at my windpipe. Sorry."
"Your hand will start to shake long before mine does."
"I'll rest the tip of my quarrel against your nose when I get tired. Who sent you after us? What are they paying you? We're not without funds. A happy arrangement could be reached."
"Actually," said Jean, "I know who sent them."
"What? Really?" Locke flicked a glance at Jean before locking eyes with his adversary once again.
"And an arrangement has been reached, but I wouldn't call it happy."
Jean, I'm afraid you've lost me."
"No."
Jean raised one hand, palm out, to the man opposite him. He then slowly, carefully shifted his aim to his left, until his crossbow was pointing at Locke's head. The man he'd previously been threatening blinked in surprise.
"You've lost me, Locke."
"Jean," said Locke, the grin vanishing from his face, "this isn't funny."
"I agree. Hand your piece over to me."
"Jean!"
"Hand it over now, smartly. You there, are you some kind of moron? Get that thing out of my face and point it at him."
Jean's former opponent licked his lips nervously, but didn't move. Jean ground his teeth together.
"Look, you sponge-witted dock ape, I'm doing your job for you. Point your crossbow at my god's damned partner so we can get off this pier."
"Jean, I would describe this turn of events as less than helpful," said Locke, and he looked as though he might say more, except that Jean's opponent chose that moment to take Jean's advice. It seemed to Locke that sweat was now cascading down his face, as though his own treacherous moisture were abandoning the premises before anything worse happened.
"There. 3-on-1.
Jean spat on the pier.
"You gave me no choice but to cut a deal with the employer of these gentlemen before we set out. God's damn it, you forced me.
I'm sorry. I thought they'd make contact before they drew down on us. Now give your weapon over."
"Jean, what the hell do you think you're..." Don't say another fucking thing. Don't try to finesse me. I know you too well to let you have your say. Silence, Locke. Finger off the trigger and hand it over."
Locke stared at the steel-tipped point of Jean's quarrel, his mouth open in disbelief. The world around him seemed to fade to that tiny gleaming point, alive with the orange reflection of the inferno blazing in the anchorage behind him. Jean would have given him a hand signal if he were lying. Where the hell was the hand signal?
"I don't believe this," he whispered. "This is impossible."
"This is the last time I'm going to say this, Locke." Jean ground his teeth together and held his aim steady directly between Locke's eyes. "Take your finger off the trigger and hand over your God's damned weapon. Right now." Part 3. Cards on the Table. I am hard pressed on my right. My center is giving way. Situation excellent. I am attacking. General Ferdinand Foch. Chapter 14. Scourging the Sea of Brass. 1. Jafrim Rodanov waded in the shallows by the hull of an overturned fishing boat, listening to the waves break against its shattered planks as they washed over his ankles. The sand and water of Prodigal Bay were pristine this far from the city. No layers of night soil slimed the water. No rusting metal scraps or pottery shards littered the bottom. No corpses floated as grim rafts for squawking birds. Twilight on the seventh day of Orim. Drakasha gone for a week now. 1,000 miles away, Jafrim thought, a mistake was being made. Idrena whistled. She was leaning against the hull of the abandoned fishing boat, neither too close nor too far from him, merely emphasizing by her presence that Rodanov was not alone, and that his attendance at this meeting was known to his crew. Jacqueline Colvard had arrived. She left her first mate beside Idrena, shrugged out of her own boots, and waded into the water without hiking up her breeches. Old and unbent Colvard, who'd been sacking ships in these waters when he'd been a boy with his nose buried in musty scrolls, before he'd even seen a ship that wasn't inked onto a sheet of parchment.
"Jafrim," she said, "thank you for humoring me."
"There's only one thing you could want to talk about at the moment," said Rodanov.
"Yes, and it's on your mind too, isn't it?"
"It was a mistake to give Drakasha our oaths."
"Was it?"
Rodanov hooked his thumbs into his sword belt and looked down at the darkening water, the ripples where his pale ankles vanished into it. "I was generous when I should have been cynical."
"So you fancy yourself the only one who had the power to forbid this?"
"I could have withheld my oath."
"But then it would have been 4 against 1, with you the one," said Colvard. "And Drakasha would have gone north looking over her shoulder all the way."
Rodanov felt a cold excitement in his gut.
"I've noticed curious things these past few days," she continued. "Your crew has been spending less time in the city. You've been taking on water. And I've seen you on your quarterdeck, testing your instruments, checking your backstaffs."
His excitement rose. Out here, alone, had she come to confront him or abet him? Could she be mad enough to put herself in his reach, if it was the former?
"You know, then," he said at last.
"Yes."
"Do you intend to talk me out of it?"
"I intend to see that it's done right."
"Ah."
"You have someone aboard the Poison Orchid, don't you?"
Though taken aback, Rodanov found himself in no mood to dissemble.
"If you'll tell me how you know," he said, "I won't insult you by denying it."
"It was an educated guess. After all, you tried to place someone aboard my ship once."
"Ah," he said, sucking air through his teeth. "So Rila didn't die in a boat accident after all."
"Yes and no," said Colvard. "It happened in a boat, at least."
"Do you
blame you? No. You're a cautious man, Jafrim, as I am a fundamentally cautious woman. It's our shared caution that brings us here this evening."
"Do you want to come with?"
"No," said Colvard. "And my reasons are practical. First, that the Sovereign is ready for sea while the Draconic is not.
Second, that two of us putting out together would cause an inconvenient degree of speculation when Drakasha fails to return.
There'll be speculation regardless, and there'll be confirmation. My crew won't bite their tongues forever.
But anything could have happened to bring one and one together on the high seas, said Colvard. If we put out in a squadron, collusion will be the only reasonable possibility.
And I suppose it's just coincidence, said Jafrim, that even several days since you first spotted my preparations, the Draconic still isn't ready for sea?
Well,
spare me, Jacqueline. I was ready to do this before we came here tonight. Just don't imagine that you've somehow finessed me into going in your place.
Jafrim, peace. So long as this arrow hits the target, it doesn't matter who pulls back the string.
She unbound her grey hair and let it fly free about her shoulders in the muggy breeze.
What are your intentions?
Obvious, I should think. Find her, before she does enough damage to give Stragos what he wants.
And should you run her down, what then? Polite messages, broadside to broadside?
A warning, a last chance.
An ultimatum for Drakasha?
Her frown turned every line on her face near vertical.
Jafrim, you know too well how she'll react to any threat, like a netted shark. If you try to get close to a creature in that state, you'll lose a hand.
A fight, then. I suppose we both know it'll come to that.
And the outcome of that fight?
My ship is the stronger, and I have 80 more souls to spare. It won't be pretty, but I intend to make it mathematical.
Zamira slain, then.
That's what tends to happen.
Assuming you allow her the courtesy of death in battle.
Allow?
Consider, said Colvard, that while Zamira's course of action is too dangerous to tolerate, her logic was impeccable in one respect.
And that is?
Merely killing her, plus this Ravel and Valora, would only serve to bandage a wound that already festers. The rot will deepen. We need to sate Maxilan Stragos' ambition, not just foil it temporarily.
Agreed. But I'm losing my taste for subtlety as fast as I'm depleting my supply, Colvard. I'm going to be blunt with Drakasha. Grant me the same courtesy.
Stragos needs a victory not for the sake of his own vanity, but to rouse the people of this city. If that victory is lurking in the waters near Tal Varar, and if that victory is colorful enough, what need would he have to trouble us down here?
We put a sacrifice on the altar, Rodanov whispered. We put Zamira on the altar.
After Zamira does some damage, after she raises just enough hell to panic the city, if the notorious pirate, the infamous rogue Zamira Drakasha, with a 5,000 solari bounty on her head, were to be paraded through Tal Varar in chains, brought to justice so quickly after foolishly challenging the city once again.
Stragos victorious, Tal Varar united in admiration.
Rodanov sighed.
Zamira hung over the midden deep in a cage.
Satisfaction in every quarter, said Colvard.
I may not be able to take her alive, though.
Whatever you hand over to the Archon would be of equal value. Corpse or quick, alive or dead, he'll have his trophy, and the Varari would swarm the streets to see it. It would be best, I suspect, to let him have what's left of the poison orchid as well.
I do the dirty work, then hand him the victor's laurels.
And the ghost winds will be spared.
Rodanov stared out across the waters of the bay for some time before speaking again.
So we presume, but we have no better notions.
When will you leave?
the morning tide. I don't envy you the task of navigating the sovereign through the trader's gate.
I don't envy myself. I'll take the parlor passage.
Even by day, Jephrim?
Hours count. I refuse to see any more wasted.
He turned for shore to retrieve his boots and be on his way. Can't buy in for the last hand if you don't get there in time to take a chair.
2. Feeling the hot sting of sudden tears in his eyes, Locke slipped his finger away from the trigger of the alley piece and slowly put it up in the air.
"Will you at least tell me why?" he said.
"Later." Jean didn't lower his own weapon. "Give me the crossbow. Slowly. Slowly!"
Locke's arm was shaking. The nervous reaction had lent an unwanted jerkiness to his movements. Concentrating, trying to keep his emotions under control, Locke passed the bow over to Jean.
"Good," said Jean. "Keep your hands up. You two brought rope, right?"
"Yeah."
"I've got him under my bolt. Tie him up. Get his hands and his feet and make the knots tight."
One of their ambushers pointed his own crossbow into the air and fumbled for rope in a jacket pocket. The other lowered his bow and produced a knife. His eyes had just moved from Locke to his associate when Jean made his next move. With his own bow in one hand and Locke's in the other, he calmly pivoted and put a bolt into the head of each of their attackers. Locke heard the sharp twack-twack of the double release, but it took several seconds for full comprehension of its meaning to travel from his eyes to the back of his skull. He stood there shaking, jaw hanging open, while the two strangers spurted blood, twitched, and died. One of them reflexively curled a finger around the trigger of his weapon. With a final twack that made Locke jump, a bolt whizzed into the darkness.
"Jean, you—"
"How difficult was it to give me the damn weapon?"
"But you said—"
"I said?" Jean grabbed him by his lapels and shook him. "What do you mean, I said, Locke? Why were you paying attention to what I was saying?"
"You didn't—"
"Gods, you're shaking. You believed me? How could you believe me?"
Jean released him and stared at him, aghast.
"I thought you were just playing along too intently."
"You didn't give me a hand signal, Jean. What the hell was I supposed to think?"
"Didn't give you a hand signal? I flashed you the lying sign, plain as that bloody burning ship."
"You did not."
"I did. As if I could forget. I can't believe this. How could you ever think—" "Where do you think I'd found the time to broker a deal with anyone else? We've been on the same damn ship for 2 months.
Jean, without the signal—"
"I did give it to you, you twit. I gave it when I did the whole cold, reluctant betrayer bit. Actually, I know who sent them, remember?"
"Yeah."
"And then the hand signal. The, 'Oh, look, Jean Tannen is lying about betraying his best friend in the whole fucking world to a couple of Ferrari cutthroats' signal. Shall we practice that one more often? Do we really need to?"
"I didn't see a signal, Jean. Honest to all the gods."
"You missed it."
"Missed it? I—"
"Yeah, look, fine, I missed it. It was dark, crossbows everywhere. I should have known. I should have known we didn't even need it. I'm sorry."
He sighed and looked over at the two bodies, feathered shafts sticking grotesquely out of their motionless heads.
"We really, really needed to interrogate one of those bastards, didn't we?"
"Yes," said Jean.
"It was bloody good shooting, regardless."
"Yes."
"Jean?"
"Hmm?"
"We should really be running like hell now."
"Oh, yes. Let's."
3.
"Ahoy the ship!"
cried Locke as the boat nudged up against the poison orchid side.
He released his grip on the oars with relief. Caldris would have been proud of the pace they'd set in scudding out of Tal Vorah, through a flotilla of priestly delegations and drunkards, past the flaming galleon and the blackened hulks of the previous sacrifices, through air still choked with grey haze.
"Gods," said Del Mastro as she helped them up the entry port. "What happened? Are you hurt?"
"Got my feelings dented," said Jean, "but all this blood has been borrowed for the occasion." Locke glanced down at his own finery, smeared with the life of at least two of their attackers. He and Jean looked like drunken amateur butchers.
"Did you get what you needed?"
asked Del Mastro.
"What we needed? Yes. What we might have wanted? No. And from the goddamn mystery attackers that won't give us a moment's peace in the city? Far too much."
"Who's this, then?"
"We have no idea," said Locke.
"How do the bastards know where we are, or who we are? It's been nearly 2 months. Where were we indiscreet?"
"The Sin Spire," said Jean, a bit sheepishly.
"How were they waiting for us at the docks, then? Pretty bloody efficient." "Were you followed back to the ship?" asked Del Mastro.
"Not that we could tell," said Jean, "but I think we'd be fools to linger."
Del Mastro nodded, produced her whistle, and blew the familiar three sharp notes.
"At the waist! Ship capstan bars! Stand by to weigh anchor! Bosun's party, ready to hoist the boat!"
"You two look upset," she said to Locke and Jean as the ship became a whirlwind of activity around them.
"Why shouldn't we be?"
Locke rubbed his stomach, still feeling a dull ache where the Sinspire bouncer had struck him.